and welcome to another episode of Retro Asylum Podcast. We have a very special episode this week. We are delving into the delights and mysteries that is Retro Games Limited. How are we doing that? Well, we have two of the founders here with us, Chris and Darren. Please introduce yourselves.
Do you want to go first, Chris?
Yeah. Hey, everyone. I'm Chris Smith. One of the founders of Retro Games. And I guess I'm responsible for getting it to work effectively from the product point of view and making it look good. I guess I'll hand over to Darren.
Well, hi, yep. I'm Darren Melbourne. I've been in the video games industry since around 1984. I think I've covered up most aspects of game design, game development, and game production over that time. And my role within Retro Games Limited is licensing content. I do the boring bits of paperwork, and I do the other bits and pieces, really, along with Paul, that Chris doesn't.
Right. Perfect. Well, now we know where we all stand. Hurrah! So, without further ado, we've got a raft of questions here for which we at Retro Asylum Towers composed very carefully amongst ourselves, the great host of hosts that we are. And this is what we come up with. So there's some logic to them, but we're basically trying to approach it from if you were at one of the expos that we attend, like, for example, you were talking about that live that went over last weekend.
Yes.
This is where it comes from, that kind of space.
Okay.
So first question is this, and there is a logic to this, by the way, everyone. And by the way, if you don't know who Retro Games Limited are, then why listen to this? I'm sure you do. But they are the ones that produce, shall we say, I was going to say miniature versions of 8-bit computers, but that is not true at all. It's basically a re-release or replacement hardware or a new hardware version of something that's very, very close to the original machine without all the flannel that hardware has. So it's basically sort of tapping into, you know, so you can actually use these machines without too much fuss. Because if you try to get one of these old machines to work on the current technology, it's really painful, which leads me on to my first question. When releasing the machines that you make, how much do you rely on users updating their firmware on them? Now, I ask this because this came up in a recent episode of This Week in Retro, which is another lovely podcast that we do support over here at Retro Asylum. And they asked the same question. This was huge. It went on for quite a while about, you know, do you rely on the fact that, you know, people will eventually update the firmware? And I suspect the answer to this is, well, I'm not going to say that. I know what the answer is, but between a pair of you, please just enlighten us. What's your position on this?
Well, look, I'll speak first, and I'll Chris, who puts the firmware updates together, will probably then chime in and had his feelings on this. But our products are made. They're put in the box as complete units. Whether people need to update firmware or not is usually entirely up to them. You know, we ship them as completely and as perfectly as possible. Occasionally a bug can slip through. It's very, very rare that happens. So the update of firmware is usually, from our perspective, it's something that we do as more of an after-service support thing where we add features in, especially when with the C64 back in the early days, we added a whole raft of extra features via firmware upgrades. It wasn't necessary to upgrade. It wasn't necessary to install them. But if users wanted to, it would certainly expand their experience and give them more bang for their buck, effectively.
Yeah. And I can see why it's important to have some plug in and just work. Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking. Chris, what's your take on this?
Well, as soon as it's shipped out of the factory, that's the last time we'll see it, effectively. Or if you see it, they're not internet connected. So, and in fact, that's one of the, as like a segue, that's one of the useful or good things about our products is that they're not internet connected. So it's like safe gaming for, you know, miners, etc. Because you know that they can't, if they're sitting in front of it, they can't go off and do other things. So they're not internet connected. And so we can't control whether or not somebody does a firmware upgrade. So we can't rely on people doing a firmware upgrade. So as Darren said, our products are as complete and as polished as we can possibly get them before they even go out the door. But quite rightly, the number of lines of code that are in our products is immense. So inevitably there's going to be the odd bug, etc. But they're very rare, as Darren points out. And you know that we've been doing this getting on for 10 years now, and so we know that our kind of bug rate is relatively low. So, but there is the odd thing that comes through, and it usually affects a very small number of people. And oftentimes we've already fixed that bug because it's, you know, we've seen it in developing the next product or something. So we'll release a firmware upgrade merely as a courtesy and this is being reported. Let's engage with the community. Let's get this out there, etc. But the problem with firmware upgrades is that they cost an awful lot of money to do. And we don't sell the firmware upgrades, so there's no income stream from doing them. And there's always a risk that somebody will, you know, something will go wrong during the firmware upgrade process, etc. So we don't want to ever have to release a firmware upgrade, really, if we can help it. That's not the idea behind them. But we do make sure that our firmware upgrade process is robust in every product, just in case we have to release something.
Right.
So it's a complicated question to answer, but mainly is we don't rely on them, but we make sure that they are, that if we have to use it, if something unforeseen slipped through, that we're able then to deal with it. The last thing that we want is the one thing to be buggy is the firmware upgrade system.
Of course.
Because that is just, yeah, that's just bad.
Yeah, and my take on it is that, if I may, is that, like I said, you want something out of the box to work. If you're going to put the firmware update, you normally are found, when you've done that, you add features. You know, like all of,
that's often the case, yeah.
That's often the case that you've had to do a bug fix, but also you take an opportunity to make some, you know, enhancements or make things easier to do.
That's normally the case. That is normally the case. And also we want to incentivize actually applying the firmware upgrade. You know, we don't want somebody to trip over a bug, you know, when they're doing something productive. So, you know, if they can install that firmware upgrade early, then fantastic, you know, because then they won't stumble over it. And, you know, we like incentivizing it. Darren and I are part of the community. We're doing this because we love doing it. And we want the products to be the products that we would buy ourselves.
Yeah.
So this kind of engagement, I mean, we can't pander to everybody's wants, of course, but this kind of engagement, you know, it is important. You know, it is important to be reactive and stuff, but not, we can't be overly because we are a really small company.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there we are.
People don't appreciate, I know, what you've achieved is amazing considering the size of your enterprise. So, the next question, that's not patronizing, by the way. That's a thing. Sorry. What criteria do you use when selecting games to feature?
I think I'll take this one first, Chris. Mm-hmm. I think our key criteria, we tend to look at lists of best in class. We then look at what our community tend to feed back to us, the games that they want to see. We're pretty much, as Chris said, we do this because it's our passion. Retro gaming is our passion. It's what we do. We are part of Facebook groups and other groups across the internet. So we look at the games people want to play. And then we really go out and try and find the games that we think will be most suitable for the platforms that we're putting together. There are obviously, you know, this is a question that I've answered countless times before. There are obviously, there's gaming content out there that the publishers, for one reason or another, are resistant to license. It's too expensive to license. It's beyond reach because companies have closed down and the trail has gone cold, really, as to who owns content. But I would say we're fairly successful. Our hit rate for the games we want to go after is usually pretty high. But it really comes down to what's best in class. You know, I think everybody would agree things like Manic Miner are absolutely synonymous with the Spectrum, for example. So it's that kind of game that we're determined to bring to both the classic audience and a new audience as well.
Yeah, agreed. There were some exceptional. And also we've got some new games or newer titles on those. And I think we delve into that later on in one of the questions. So I'll keep my powder dry on that one. Chris, any thoughts on this? Or is it something you really...
Well, as Darren said, you know, there's always from you know, everybody in the company, there's always a list of personal favourites that we put into the mix, obviously, because we are a representative group, I think. Mm-hmm. So it does help inform decisions in that sense. Things which particularly showcase the hardware as well as being iconic titles like Man in Mind, for instance. You know, there are certain titles that we know are you know, we would say we must have this because it really does demonstrate the best of what the Spectrum could do or the A500 could do or that kind of stuff. Right. So there's those aspects as well, because there's a community of people and people have got different things which like float their boats. You know, it's like featuring on the 64, for instance, originally. It's making sure that we had a selection of games that had Rob Hubbard music, for instance.
Yes.
That kind of, you know, there's that aspect that goes into it. It's not just the obvious things of you know, this was a Zap Smash or whatever it was called, or a Zap Sizzler and all that kind of stuff. You know, that does inform us. But we also look at current reviews, current community ratings as well, because some games haven't stood the test of time, despite being a crash match.
This is true, etc. You know? This is true.
So there's that aspect. There's all the softer aspects around it as well. But you know, available, as Darren said, all of, you know, availability and that's a big thing that often influences us not being able to get something. Actually, it's usually usually the reverse. You know, where we can't have something we ultimately would.
Yeah, yeah, I can appreciate it's a licensing quagmire, to say the least.
It's fun. And Chris, you just made a very valid point. The music of Rob Hubbard definitely influenced our licensing decisions for the
C64. Yeah.
Yeah. Next question, then. This is about the audience. Mm-hmm. So you've got a very broad audience, I think, of people who pick up a retro games limited machine. Everything from someone who vaguely remembers playing on these devices 20, 30 years ago to someone who's deeply ensconced in the retro gaming scene and sees these things and thought, what possible use is that for me? That's a bit crude, but you know what I mean. They figure it out eventually, as I've explained, that it means that it preserves the machines you actually do have. Sounds strange, but you know, speaking personally, my Spectrum, my default Spectrums is my Next and the Spectrum. There it is. They're the two machines that's my Spectrum, sort of, because they are very, very new piece of technology. So how do you find catering to such a broad selection of people? You get everyone from barely knowing, you know, how to hook up HDMI right through to someone who's probably tried to hardwire a cartridge port in the C64. You know, how have you found dealing with this broad church?
Do you know, I've got two young children, and I use them really as my acid test with each new machine. And they've reacted to gaming on a platform that they've got no prior experience of in the most wonderful way. Especially, I've got to say, that the tactile nature of the Spectrum was the thing that they were drawn to probably more than any machine we've made prior to that point. I think the joystick for the younger children, my daughter's 9, the joystick was kind of an alien concept to her, but actually the rubber keyboard on the Spectrum meant she was playing games that she could interact with in a way that she intuitively understood. I think we're quite lucky. We seem to have bridged that gap. I'll go slightly further. Chris, you weren't at Zap this weekend due to crushing deadlines on some projects. So Chris didn't attend this weekend. And we had several people come up who were actually buying some of our machines. And what resonated, actually what really stood out to me there was, on two or three different occasions, the people coming up to buy them were children. When I say children, I would say between 12 and 16. And their parents were footing the bill, bless them. But it was the children who actually came up and chose to buy the hardware. So, and that's the first time I've witnessed that. Previously, it's always I would say first generation gamers, people our age actually, who interact with us and come and buy our hardware. But this weekend was the first time I saw a departure from that, and I saw much younger gamers coming up and actually interacting with us, talking with us quite knowledgeably about older hardware and older gaming, and actually buying our hardware.
Awesome. That's wonderful to hear.
It was heartwarming, genuinely heartwarming.
Yeah, who knew?
Indeed. I think, in fact, again, I'll wax lyrical. I'll shut up in just a second. We were talking to a father and his daughter. I think she must have been around 14 or 15. And she was discussing how BASIC worked on a Spectrum on a C64, but she eventually went for the C64 out of the two machines because although she thought the BASIC wasn't as good as the Spectrum BASIC, in her opinion, she preferred the musical capabilities of a C64.
Ooh, there's a playground argument.
I'm not even getting into that.
No, because that's my take on the C64. I mean, I'll never forget on when Twitter was, you could use it. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah.
You can't anymore. And someone put out a mere image saying, how to draw a circle on a C64. And it's like, there's like 20 lines of code. And then how to draw a circle on the Spectrum.
And it was one instruction, yeah.
Yeah, not the 64, they were all poke commands.
It's poke commands, yeah. Peek and poke. And like I always said, you know, any BASIC that requires you to check the memory address is not BASIC.
That's true.
I don't think it is. That's assembly, come on. Well, it's not, but you know what I mean.
It's
close to it.
Yeah.
What's your take on this, Chris, and an audience?
Yeah.
From a production point of view, you must have that in the back of your mind.
I've got a particular set of skills which I've developed over many years as a technical architect working for the central government. And once I'd got my head around the difference between user need and what we think they want and what a user might want, I can't forget that. So I get very, very passionate about understanding, but also about sticking true to the realization that once somebody's learned something, asking them to relearn that thing is not only difficult, they may not realize they have to learn something, you know, old habits and that. And where I'm going with that is if we can make our user interface be as straightforward and as aligned with lots of other products that a user's used to interacting with, be it, I don't know, Netflix, Apple Music, Fire TV, all these kind of like, you know, user interfaces and stuff, then they'll instantly be able to engage with our product and you know, experience what it can do. I mean, I'm that's broad strokes. That's a real sort of like high level kind of thing and to be sort of picking out, because it goes a little bit deeper than that. It's things like, one of the company mottos really, which, you know, I should get some T-shirts made with it, and I often say this on interviews and things, is we try and get our products to do 80% of what 80% of people want.
Okay. That's
which, when you take a moment to think about it, actually makes a lot of sense. It's that top 20% that is usually unachievable, and it's where that fighting ground is, where everybody wants something different, you know.
And normally someone else has got that covered.
No. Well, exactly. They're the people who our products aren't for. So yeah. Those esoteric features that a very small number of people want to use. So it's a small number of features needed by a small number of people. Yes, the emulator might have them, but as soon as you offer that feature up, it usually makes the user interface and the way of accessing that a little bit more complicated. And it's there for everybody to see and for a lot of people to stumble into and get confused as to what that's about, unless you're knowledgeable. And so therefore it detracts from the experience from everybody, but yet it ticks a box for three people. So understanding that is very difficult, and we have to immerse ourselves in the products. I mean, all the products we've done so far, we all in the company, well, not everybody, but most of us know these products and know what the sort of key features are. And certainly the 64 and the Spectrum are both products that, I mean, I cut my chops on the Spectrum. You know, I was a game program working for Microgen back in the 80s. Yes, I had a mechanical keyboard on my Spectrum because, you know, typing for a long time on the rubber keyboard was impossible.
Yes.
Et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, we fundamentally understand what the Spectrum is and what the Spectrum needs to do. So things like accelerating the tape, but not just making it so it loads really quickly. We fundamentally understand that people want that nostalgic connection with the loading screens and the flashing borders and the animated loading that would be there. and similar things on the 64 as well. So it's a battle because we've got finite resources, finite time. Time is money and all that kind of thing. So it takes a lot of effort. We're getting better at it as well, which is, you know, the more that we do and the more interaction with users. And as we said, you know, earlier about firmware upgrades, we have tweaked a few things and added a few features in. Like we added in on the A500, the auto crop thing. So when you're playing a game, if you press the home button and Y, it will auto crop the screen to get rid of the black borders. And so it would scale to be larger on the television. Whereas it might be a little bit more like not a postage stamp, but more like a letter in the middle of your screen because it's still got these black borders on it. And we had the auto crop feature in there, but you couldn't do it live while you were playing a game. And it was a customer feedback thing that pointed that out. And it's like, that is so obvious now you've mentioned it, but we hadn't thought of that. So we respond to that and put that feature in. So it is difficult to accommodate user need because it's a disparate set. But if we can get that core 80 of 80, 80% of what 80% of the features of what 80% of people want, then we're doing quite well. And I think our success rate is quite high. I mean, you can speak to that. You've got several of the products.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was about to say, I think the best example I can think of, and it's not to take away anything you've done at all. Please don't think that. But if you want a C64 that does everything, like you want to put in an old floppy disk drive onto it, or you want to load a game from tape or something onto it, then get an Ultimate 64 because they're brand new.
Absolutely.
And they're beautiful. I've got one. I've got the beige one because A, I don't want TMU C64, and B, I don't want TMU C64. Sorry, that's what we in Retro Asylum call the one that lights up. It looks like something from TMU. Sorry, Commodore, but it does. Anyway, in our opinion. But the point being is that does the things that you want. If you want to go that far, knock yourself out. Go ahead.
Isn't it a great time to be alive if you're into retro gaming?
It is. It's incredible. Right. Next question.
It's like buses, isn't it? You wait 40 years and all of a sudden a load of C64s come along at once.
Yeah. Just the worst. I want to talk about special editions.
Okay.
Because I was really excited by the C64 one, the jet black one. Mm-hmm. Very pretty. I really liked it. I saw the EGX last year. Very pretty. And then there's, of course, now there's the white spectrum. Mm-hmm. And there's a special edition that comes with other things, which we're going to talk about later on in this show. Why? Well, what's the thinking? Was there a desire for this? Was you thought, oh, I've got an idea? Was it inspired by things? Because, of course, the spectrum special edition is white, which is based on that, I think it's 1,000th? I don't know, 1 millionth?
I think it's the 1 millionth.
One millionth spectrum sold. So where does this come from?
So the black was something we discussed internally for quite some time. And we decided we want to do it as a celebration of more modern gaming content. You alluded earlier on that we had some modern gaming on there. Well, primarily we have that on the black. There have been some truly spectacular games written on the C64. Effectively since its demise, and I would say since 1990 through the noughties and then more recent in the last decade, I mean, games like A Pig's Quest or Planet Golf, which my son and I are both slightly addicted to, and Sam's Journey are just spectacular. I mean, Planet Golf, if you look at it, it's very simple, but it mixes more modern gamification techniques. Sam's Journey, if it had been written in the early 80s, would have been the best-selling C64 game in history, and we wanted an opportunity to bring some of these games to C64 users who may not have been aware of them. And if we're going to go onto the Spectrum White, quite simply, it's what you alluded to when you said you thought it was very pretty. I think it's beautiful. Aesthetically, it is an absolutely beautiful machine. We had one set up, again, shock horror, we had one set up at Zap this weekend. It garnered a whole lot of attention.
There was really? At the C64 event? I thought there'd been like pitchforks and, you know, torches. No. We had this sort of thing.
We had a VIC-20 set up, we had a 64 set up, and we had a white spectrum, and it was getting a whole lot of attention. And I think purely because it is aesthetically just a beautiful looking machine. We'd seen, obviously, we knew of the white edition, obviously from Clive's special white edition. I'll also say at Zap last year, I saw a one-off special white Next, and it staggered me just how gorgeous it was.
Yeah.
And Chris and I, it went up for auction. So Chris and I went for the auction. We didn't win it, obviously. Someone else did. And we resolved we just have to make our own.
Yeah.
Because it's so gorgeous, we should do one as well.
Very pretty. I've got a Next one, so I've had it since the 2020, during the dark times, during the Animal Crossing times.
Yes.
So. not so happy, but hey, I like making my island. It's gone now, though. Chris, any thought? Because you, being a man of, you know, centered around getting this stuff out, surely this kind of like, you know, whiteboard thinking, like, please stop, please make them stop. Or was it something like, oh, this is an awesome idea? Or mixed you do it both?
No, well, like I said, like Darren said, you know, it's as the founders, when we get in the room and start thinking about these things, there are lots of things that come into play. I mean, the black 64 was something we toyed around doing, and then this idea emerged, as Darren said, about making it a platform for new games, basically. So basically, there hadn't been a black 64, so we made one with new content on it, because it was all new, if you see what I'm saying. When we came to think about the white spectrum, that's an entirely different argument behind it, really, or reasoning behind it, because, like Darren said, we'd seen the white spectrum Next. And the thing about when Clive was awarded by the Timex Mag factory in Dundee this token white spectrum that was, marking the millionth unit to come off the production line, those of us who were in playground turf wars with the C64 camp, my best friend had the C64 and I had Spectrum, so between the two of us, we had the best of both worlds. But, you know, there were still these playground wars between the Commodore and the Sinclair owners. The BBC people, we just kind of left them in the corner. Mark's just kind of irrelevant. But when this white Spectrum was touted by Clive Sinclair, it was almost, that fact was almost touted around as a badge of honor, as validation that the Spectrum was excellent because it sold a million units, and it kind of gave it, I don't know, for a moment in the eyes of a child, I guess of a teenager, it kind of gave it the argument that Spectrum is better than the 64, a little boost in the argument. And for a lot of people, there's a lot of, it's not folklore, but there's a lot of like fondness and nostalgia and reverence, I guess, around this white spectrum that of which there was only ever one. So to tap into that just felt the right thing to do, because we brought out the Spectrum as a celebration of the Spectrum. You know, I love that platform. It's, you know, I still tinker with the Spectrum now, and I loved creating the Spectrum. So to do a white one was just, it was just, we just couldn't unsee it once we thought about doing it. It was just
like, no, it's an exceptional idea. When I first saw it late last year, I was very tempted, but then, you know, sense came to me, like, Chris, come on.
Well, people have loved it. I'm thrilled that it got, as you said, it garners a lot of attention.
It does.
That Zap event.
Yeah,
it was quite tricky to do, actually. You just think, oh, that's quite straightforward. But no, that we, you know, we had to change colours, getting, there's three different materials on it. There's a white plastic, there's a white paint, and there's a white rubber. And we needed the colour more from all. It was really, really hard. There's all these subtle engineering things that are in there.
And of course, you should be able to read the keys, otherwise it's useless.
And you can read the keys. But yeah, so we had to change the contrast. We had to change the colour depth of the main colours that you see. So it's not something that we just use white rubber and use white plastic and change the black to be a white paint. Hey, we're done. It was a process.
Indeed. And I'm going to stick with the hardware thing, because I really want to talk to you about this, these peripherals from ages gone by. Yes, your original did come out with a Competition Pro-like joystick. Wasn't actually, I mean, but it's very close to it. And there's been improvements and modifications to it over the years. But then you did the Quickshot 2 thing. That came out of nowhere. I didn't see that coming at all. Well done for that. And also, there's the printer, which, oddly enough, Dean Swain, when we had a recent episode of the Retro Asylum, talking about all new technology that's coming out, which we're going to finish off on, everyone, when we sign off this podcast. But we're going to talk about, you know, how did this come about? You know, there's these peripherals, these things that I thought you were not going to delve into, but it turns out you are, kind of, and nibbling away at the edges. I mean, QuickShot 2 is like a iconic joystick, but the printer? I mean, I just have to ask, how's this coming about, and how are you finding recreating these devices?
It came about as a sheer moment of madness, if I'm being brutally honest. It was Chris, myself, and Stuart were sitting together, having a coffee, talking about what we were going to do next, and then the printer came up into conversation. And as fast as other members of the team were saying, that's insane, you can't do that, there were other members of the team saying, well, we have to do it now, we've thought of it. And now I'm going to hand this over to Chris, because now we've had the idea, the actual process of making this thing work and putting it together, I'm glad is Chris's and not mine, because it's a far more tricky enterprise than you would at first believe.
It's really hard.
Describe what it is, because a lot of listeners still don't know how these devices work. I mean, I do own the original, so yep. I do know how they work, and yes, it does still work. And I do know how it burns paper, for want of a better phrase. Chris, I'm sure you're going to challenge me on that. It's not true, but it kind of does. But
it kind of does. So yeah. The ZX printer, so that came out for the ZX81.
It did.
So it predated the Spectrum. It's got a 10-centimetre wide roll of black paper that has a silver coating on it, silver aluminium Correct. Powder coating on it.
Yes.
Which gives it kind of a pewter grey colour, I guess.
Yep.
And there are basically two styli on a band. There's a bit like the timing belt in your car, mm-hmm. That basically whizzes across the paper, and it's got a 50 volt supply, you know, that generates 50 volts. And it just basically vaporizes that really thin coating of aluminium on the top, so you see the black underneath. So it's a really clever, cheap solution, hampered only by the availability of the silver metalized paper.
It's basically Etch-a-Sketch.
It's basically Etch-a-Sketch. Brilliant. Nobody's ever said that. It's Etch-a-Sketch on a toilet roll.
It is. It is. And yeah. It smells. Oh, God, the smell.
It does. People say, it's ozone. It's not ozone. It's just that it's fine. Yeah.
So,
doing this stuff is, I mean, you say about peripherals and the difficulty of making them. I mean, so just take the Spectrum keyboard. I mean, that in itself, that was very difficult. Sinclair made this on a budget, 40 years ago, the Spectrum keyboard. And today, with our manufacturing partners, they were using like modern processes. So we were using a company that, or through them, we're using a company that creates the silicone buttons that are underneath the buttons on your gamepad, or are underneath the plastic buttons, or in fact, maybe the buttons of your Fire TV stick remote or your television remote control. But we were trying to make this rubber keyboard, basically, and they were making them. They were on mats of three keyboards by four across by four keyboards high. So it was like, a stack of these keyboards on there. And we were finding that you press the keyboard in the top left and like the one key, it was really squeegee. And you press space on the other one, and it was really hard. They couldn't get any consistency because they were just used to doing just smaller things. So yep. We ended up finding a company. Well, I had to fly out to China. Literally, I said I would be there in 24 hours. And I flew out the next day, 13-hour flights, and just sat down in a room and said, look, we've got to sort this out, because Sinclair could do this 40 years ago. Surely now in 2024, I think that's what it was, yeah, we can do better, you know. And they kind of like were like, oh, yeah, that's a gauntlet laid down. Okay. So we found a company that could do, they did rubber iPad keyboards. They had to modify their tooling, because they don't make them the way that the Sinclair keyboard is made anymore. So it had to be sort of special tooling, but their process was close enough to what we needed to do it identically. So it's that kind of challenge. So the printer is particularly difficult. Do you want to talk about the QuickShot as well, where that came, how that?
I mean, we can delve into that a little bit if you'd love to, because, I mean, I had...
Because, again, the QuickShot's quite... And this is where we struggle. It's because things like joysticks, people aren't used to them anymore. And when you're looking at something to be manufactured, you will inevitably at some point in that process want to be thinking about design for manufacture. This thing needs to be manufactured, and it needs to be manufactured as quickly as possible, because there's a cost, and so the more you can do, the cheaper it is. So that's always a factor that you're trying to balance between it being too long as opposed to rushing it out the door. But mainly it's quality assurance and quality. You don't want something that's fiddly or got multiple parts, multiple screws, etc. It needs to be as straightforward as possible and be as repeatable as possible in that sense. So the more manual you make it, the more variability you build into that assembly process. And so you get different quality levels coming out the other end, which, of course, we're striving to have quality up to 100%, you know, identical every single unit. But we're also striving for authenticity. And that's where it gets tricky, because we need the QuickShot joystick to feel exactly as the original does, but without using the same switches and things that the original used, because they weren't reliable. They wore very quickly and it all became very floppy, and they had a tendency to snap because they were just basically spring levers. So we're trying to marry modern, and it's also a ball joint. It's a ball joint, and the pivot is a really stiff, compressed, not squashed spring, yeah, but a very stiff spring. It's almost like a flexible rod. And trying to get the guys, manufacturing guys, to get their heads around how that mechanical design works. Because we do all the work here, and we do all the CAD designs, and we ship them over to our colleagues in China, and they take them on board. And they often, just because of what they're used to seeing, they often overlook the tiny subtleties that make the difference in these things. And so that's hard, particularly because of the language barrier, etc. But just because of myself and Darren and Paul and the rest of the team, we're immersed in this retro stuff, and we really understand it's got to feel like this. And when you're relying on somebody out in China, and I mean, anecdotally, we said, this must feel exactly like the D-pad on a PS4 controller for something else we were doing. And they said, oh yeah, this is absolutely spot on. It feels exactly the same. They sent it over to us, and it was a million miles away from what a PS4 controller would feel like. And so that's a challenge. That's a challenge because of distance, etc. And
yeah,
and processes are different. Availability of components are different. And so we've got to re-engineer or adapt processes, or adapt actually, or compromise some of the authenticity that we're really striving for in order to be able to get it done at all. Mm. And that leads straight into the printer, really. So the printer, there are thermal printers out there, so we can get a thermal printer mechanism, but there's finding one that's the right size. They're chunkier than the Spectrum or the ZX printer mechanism was. So we have that. We're trying to get it into exactly the same case size, but there are challenges around that. Paper availability is better. That's fantastic. We need to get a printer mechanism that has got the right can achieve the right resolution, because you're still printing a Spectrum. You don't want it to be tiny, tiny. So the Spectrum resolution was 256 pixels. So it's got to be a multiple of 256 pixels or close to, rounding up. So that's the hard part. And we are beholden, of course, to our manufacturing partners who go out and source all these things. And they're very good, but there's a balancing act between the authenticity and manufacturability, and ultimately cost as well. I mean, we can do anything, but it will cost an absolute, you know, fortune, which is why our products don't do absolutely everything. And you can't plug a cartridge into, you know, one of our C64s, even though it looks like you probably could, because it's, like you said, it's newer tech. But the cost involved of satisfying that smaller number of people makes the product price go up from, I don't know, £100 to £300 or £400.
Ultimate 64 price.
The Ultimate 64. It's a different market.
Yeah, doesn't work. You know, so, but sorry to compare, and I'm not comparing at all. I think they're completely different devices. Genuinely do. So, you know.
They are.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Chris, they coexist. You make a fair point as well. We are exceptionally price sensitive. We do spend a lot of time and effort making the highest quality products we can, but aiming to try and get them at a retail price that we think people can sensibly afford.
Yeah.
So I want to move on now to the future.
Mm.
You're delving into handheld land, which is great, because you know, it's quite topical, really, because I'm currently playing through Loco Roco on my PSP at the moment. Mm-hmm. Awesome game, full of joy.
Yep.
Just so much joy, Chris and Darren. So much. and are hoping that this joy will then spread into these two new handhelds you've got. Now, I've, you know, speaking transparently, I have pre-ordered the Spectrum one. I was drawn to that. It reminded me of my DSi, which was jet black as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if that was that the modelling is kind of similar because it looks very close to it, the same kind of, you know, boxy sort of feeling to it. But tell why. There it is. Why have you done this? I mean, I think I know why, but you share with the world. Why have you gone into the realms of handhelds?
It's, to be fair, it's something we've been talking about for as long as the company's been in existence. We conceptually talked about doing a handheld C64 and then a Spectrum as far back as 10 years ago. It's just with a small team, which we still are, you know, we're still only, I think, nine people. We just were finding it difficult to find the bandwidth and the resources available to put them together. We've been working side by side with our friends at Evercade, and we know those guys pretty well, and we've been talking with them for some time. And it was over a coffee a year or so ago that we sat down with Andrew, the CEO of Evercade, and we suggested doing it as a joint venture and doing it together. And that's basically where it was born.
Fantastic, because we're big fans of Evercade here as well. I've just got the Activision Collection 2.
Excellent.
What, so good. So good. Although River yeah. Raid 2, what a bit of a fusspot game. Left it alone. First one was awesome. Left it alone. Although Pitfall 2, now that's a good one.
That is a good one. Yeah,
that's
it is.
A corker. But no, I'm so happy that you've actually merged and spoke. I mean, I had no idea you had direct relations with them, but it's lovely to hear that. And it's and the product of that friendship and that understanding, that empathy, if you like, wonderful to hear that it's these handhelds.
To be honest with you, it's not a massive industry. Well, I say that the retro industry has got much bigger again than when we first conceived the company. And we've always been very much of the belief that if we can help even people that are seen as a competitor of ours, they're really not. You know, I don't see them as cannibalistic to us, and we're not cannibalistic to them. If we can help them, we will. And if they can help us, they absolutely do. Are you familiar with the online service of AntStream Arcade?
Yes, very familiar. Like,
you know, I also license products for AntStream Arcade. I was one of the first employees there. I've worked with Steve, the CEO there, who is maniacally passionate about retro gaming. And it's again, we all work together in a retro community. AntStream have supported Evercade, and Evercade have supported AntStream. We've all worked together for years now, and we just don't see the point in having it as a competition when we can support each other. And we tend to be very much of the belief that if one rises, all rise. And I think that's very much proven to be the case over the past decade, because 10 years ago, retro was seen very much as a hobby still, and it was still it didn't have the same kind of prevalence within gaming as it does now. And I think in the last decade, retro's become a subset or a subgenre of regular gaming. It's always been there, but I don't think it was as accepted as it is now. And I think what we're doing, what Evercade are doing, what AntStream are doing, what New Commodore are doing, what Atari are doing, it's fantastic. So I know I've gone a little bit off piece there. I'm on a soapbox and waxing lyrical. That's how the handhelds came about. Is
due no, you answered the question.
It's your partnership with their friends at Evercade.
Fantastic. There you go. That answers that question. And I would let you dive into here, Chris, but time's against us.
No.
If you don't mind. And I just want to really, really want to ask you this question. And you might, you know, it's something I've always wanted to ask you guys directly. It's just a shame that I personally, I know we've been, you know, you've Retro Games Limited had a relationship with Retro Asylum going back many, many, many years, I'm happy to say. And long may it continue.
Yeah.
But here's the question I have to ask you both.
Go.
You've tackled Commodore.
Mm-hmm.
You've done Sinclair. You've done the Atari 8-bit. You've done the Amiga. Without getting yourself into trouble, what other machine would you like to have covered maybe in the future? And you can't say Vectrex because that's already been doing.
Isn't it great? what a great achievement that is!
And I've got a working Vectrex, Darren, because of course I have. But I'm one of the tiny, 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 tiny percentage of people in the world that has a working Vectrex.
And they become harder to get because obviously, as the hardware becomes tired and older, fairly soon you're going to have to plug in your Vectrex Mini.
every time I turn that thing on, I just go, please don't, please don't, please don't.
I know, right?
But if you can't answer this question, that's fine. But I'd like to think you're working on something or looking at something.
Chris, you can shoot me for this later. I would say, obviously, the world knows about the 1200.
Yes.
But I would also like to say that we're working on two or three other things concurrently. And I'm afraid I'm going to leave it hanging there because I will
you
get
have to.
Shot if
you
I say too much more. But we're working on two or three other projects at the same time.
Very good.
Yeah.
Chris, can you expand on that? Or is this basically mirrors what Darren's saying?
No, I'm not
doing a journalist thing. I'm not. This is not a kind of podcast. I'm just like...
No, but
go on.
Can you hear this?
Yes.
There you are. That's one of the products that Darren's been talking about.
It's an IBM M1 keyboard. Wow, that's amazing.
No, you won't know what that is, but it's... that's something that I've had for sign off. So Darren said, yeah, we're working on the 1200 Holt, and there is a sleuth of other things that we are actively working on, and there's a list behind that.
Yes, it's this, the Auric one, everyone. You heard it first. I'm kidding.
Do you know, I love the Auric one.
Do you know, honestly,
I've got one as well. I'm sorry, but
we had quite a long conversation, Stuart and I, about the Auric one at the weekend.
Wow. It's a very underrated machine. It's a very, very capable machine. So, Chris, Darren, it's been wonderful having you on the show. It genuinely has. Absolute honour. And you'll be great guests. We could have you for another hour, but time is short and pressing. And we've covered pretty much everything I wanted to go through. There was a couple of things that we might have delved into, but it would have gone down a real rabbit hole, everyone. So we'll call it there. You're more than welcome to come back to chat about those very things that you could only allude to a moment ago. Go on.
We'd love to. Let's do it again at some point in the future.
Yeah, do it again. Absolutely. I don't know if you know this, but I'll leave you with this. But we at Retro Asylum are famous for our 8-Bit Wars podcast, where we basically pitch each for the three major platforms. You know, the one I'm talking about is the Spectrum, the C64, and the Amstrad. And you'd be surprised, maybe not, but the Amstrad has been so far the overall winner on three separate occasions. Don't. Because basically we took one game and we said, okay, we played this one game on all those three different platforms, and whoever was the best game, you know, by the judges, wins. And that's how it worked.
Okay.
So I know, but last time we did it with the budget games, all the 199s and the 299s, and the C64 won that one for obvious reasons. But what I'm saying is, you feed into that, you still give us that buzz of people still caring, and people love those episodes when we hurl abuses at each other. But but it's important that scene's still going, and you actually are very much part of creating that energy around these machines that are long since expired, and you're just basically bringing them back to life. So on behalf of Retro Silent audience and the retro gaming community, I just want to say thank you for your efforts. If you don't hear that often enough, I'm saying it now. Thank you. So Darren and Chris and all the other cohorts, we thank you very much for all what you do, and it is appreciated.
Thank you. We will continue to try and live up to the standards that the community demands, rightly so.
Yeah.
Well, definitely. We'll sign off there then. Thank you very much for you both. And again, wish you the very, very best of luck in your future endeavours. And we will be watching very, very closely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.